welcome back to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff, and today we're going to be talking with Mary Daly from Atlanta, Georgia. Mary spent many years taking care of her husband, who is diagnosed with Alzheimer's, but she also learned some important lessons about taking care of herself. And this is an important conversation for all caregivers, that you not only need to take care of the person who needs your help, you also need to take care of yourself and make sure that you come through this experience in good shape. We also have our first mailbag question today that we're going to use on the air. This question comes from Nicola, and it sparked a wonderful conversation with Rod Brohard, a paramedic from California, that I believe you will enjoy. We're going to talk about Medic Alert bracelets and how you can convey the important information about you and your condition to emergency personnel. So we have a well-packed hour ahead of us, and I hope that you will stay with us and enjoy the conversation. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on the website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger by Clinton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. At this point, I'd like to introduce you, Mary Daly from Atlanta, Georgia. Mary, we're delighted to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I read some of your story in the newspaper. Would you share with us, please, a little bit about your own experience as being a caregiver?
Well, I surely will. First of all, my husband and I met in high school in the 10th grade in the French class. Graduated from high school. I went to college there. He went away to school and became a naval aviator, a carrier pilot. And because of his profession, we discussed death and perhaps being disabled, and he'd often said his worst fear would be to lose his mind, to have something wrong with his mind, so that when he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, this was a terrific blow to both of us. And the doctor said that he had probably had Alzheimer's for about 10 years before he was diagnosed. But to go back a little bit, after he retired from the Naval Academy. He was a naval aviator. He went back to school and got a doctorate in psychology. And it was then that he began to say something was wrong. He couldn't remember from patient to patient what was said. Even his notes looked foreign to him. So this, again, was his worst fear, and we decided that we would just face it together. At that time, we had five children, and they were scattered all over the country. One in Seattle, one in Santa Barbara, one in Fort Worth, but we had one in Atlanta and another in Spartanburg. So after his diagnosis, we decided that it probably would be better to be closer to some of our children. At the time of the diagnosis, we were in Florida. So we decided we would move halfway between Atlanta and Spartanburg. So we went to Anderson, South Carolina, but as his symptoms became worse, then we decided that we had to choose. And the son in Spartanburg was a pediatrician, and his wife was too. And we just felt that their lives were so involved that they wouldn't be able to pay attention. So our daughter won the toss, and we moved to Decatur, which is really in Atlanta. So that's where we have been. Brad did die in May of this last year. And I'm still here in Decatur.
Right. And his needs began to increase over the years.
Yes. At first, when he was diagnosed, no one could tell anything was wrong. It progresses very slowly. And as one nurse told me, she said, we do not treat Alzheimer's patients. We treat a patient because everyone is different. And everyone goes through sort of the same stages, but not in the same order. For instance, Brad did reach a stage where he wandered at night. And one night I awoke to a noise and found that he had gone into the kitchen, turned on all of the burners on the stove, and was cooking orange juice in a pan. Well, it scared me because he could have caught fire. Any number of things could have happened. So that was one stage that some people go through and some people don't. So Brad's symptoms were really forgetfulness, of course, a little paranoia once in a while, thinking that someone was trying to find him, to do him harm. But for the most part, he was a wonderful patient. He accepted all of this with a great deal of courage, and I was very lucky not to have... First of all, I was lucky that he was a small man, because if he'd been a large man, I don't think that I could have cared for him as I did, because he began to fall, and I'd have to get him up off the floor. He became unable to handle his toileting and bathing. I had to take care of all of that, learn to change him. In fact, I've really learned to be sort of a nurse, and I think you have to do that if you're caregiving.
Mm-hmm. Or certainly a nurse's aide.
Well, that's it. I did go to a conference of nurses sponsored by the people at Emory here in Atlanta, and they were so helpful. They ran a little video showing how to change the bed with the patient in it and answered questions. This is, you know, when you're thrown into a caregiver situation, as I was, I had no idea what to do. And I think one of the first things you should do is to contact any agency, in my case, the Alzheimer's Association, for a list of people who can help you. And then you have to learn techniques for lifting, and you have to be careful of your body language, because especially Alzheimer's patients become very, very aware, acutely aware of the tone of your voice or your body language, and they feel that they're in the way, that you would be better off without them. And this is not a good thing. So I had to be very careful to try to be, try not to show fatigue and not to show resentment or anger, because I felt those at times. Everybody does. But it's something that you get used to in a way, and you have to be aware of.
You also have to be careful not to overdo it physically so that you don't strain your own body, right?
Well, that's very true. I did have to learn, as I said, techniques for lifting. But everybody says, and I know every caregiver has heard this, take care of yourself. Well, easier said than done. To take care of yourself, you do need time to yourself. This is very important. But to have time for yourself, you have to find someone to take care of your patient or someone that you're caring for. And to find someone qualified, you can't just get a regular sitter. It has to be someone who can help him to the bathroom or change him or, you know, care for him physically. Mm-hmm. And that's expensive. So that's the time when you must lean on every agency you can find if you just don't have the financial funds to hire somebody who will charge you, as here in the Atlanta area, I think it does $18 an hour. So if you get 4 hours out for yourself, it adds up.
So right.
Lean on the agencies. There are many who will help you, many volunteers, through churches, through community organizations. It takes some looking, but you can find someone.
And sometimes family members will pitch in as well.
Oh, well, yes, and that's why we moved closer to a daughter. She has been marvelous, and right there when I needed her, and you have to be aware that they have a life too, and you can't lean on them too much. But once in the middle of the night when Brad had fallen and I could not get him up off the floor, my son-in-law came dashing over, and it's wonderful to be near family. But sometimes if you find yourself isolated and you don't have family, then you must develop friends of neighbors and people who can help.
Right, and as you mentioned, he was a smaller man, and you were able to help him get up off the floor, but I can imagine a lot of people in your situation would not be physically able to do that. So there are tools that one can use. There's lifts and things like that.
That's right.
Right.
actually, at one point, I did call 911, and they sent the fire department out, and these two huge men came and lifted Brad as if he were a sack of potatoes and put him back in bed.
Right.
And we're walking out the door, and I was thanking them so much, and they, oh, you're welcome, and they say, we do this all the time. So, you know, there's help if you know whom to call.
That's right, and 911 is better than getting yourself into a situation that you can't handle. It's if you wind up in the hospital, that's not good for anybody.
Well, there you go. It certainly isn't, and I had to stop and think about that often. You know, all caregivers, I think, have a sense of fear in the first place. Am I doing anything wrong, or am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the best I can for my person I love a lot? Or fatigue, you get so physically and emotionally drained. And resentment, there are times when I think, why me? But then you feel guilty even for thinking that. So all of those together is very debilitating, and you do need something. And the something for me was a project that I really enjoyed and that I could work at through the internet and over the telephone, and when I had to go out to see someone at that time, I could have someone come in and take care of Brad. But you need to make a list of everything that you really like to do, just everything, and then pick out two or three that you know that with a little effort you can probably do, and then do it. Make yourself get out if it's nothing more than walking around the block or seeing a movie or playing bridge or something that will get you out with other people and give you a sense of yourself.
So tell us about your project.
Well, one of the things that I did when Brad was diagnosed was to try to find everything I could about Alzheimer's. And one of the things I kept running into was the fact that exercise could delay symptoms of Alzheimer's and also help with depression, which both of us experience, by the way. Depression is sort of goes along with it. But I read in a Scottish newspaper that Great Britain was trying to pass legislation so that exercise could be prescribed for mild depression because it was found to be equally as good for depression, mild depression, as medication. Of course, only a doctor can tell you what's mild and what's not, but I thought, what a good thing. And since our daughter was a personal trainer, the one who lives in Santa Barbara, I called her and asked her if she could devise some exercises that Brad and I could do. Because at that point, Brad had lost the ability to read. He couldn't write his own name. He couldn't watch television with any understanding. Mm-hmm. We couldn't communicate, really. And so I thought, well, if we could exercise together, that would be something we could do together, and it would benefit both of us. So Lynn did devise these exercises, and I began on the telephone and with the internet and just talking with various people. Found a wonderful lady who owned something called Video Progressions. It filmed videos for people. And I filmed and produced an exercise video for Alzheimer's patients and their caregivers. And it won an award, by the way, a Telly Award. The doctors, I went to neurologists, and they gave me the okay. I called Harvard Magazine to make sure that I could use one of their quotes, and they said, yes, indeed, I could. And so, in other words, I spent about 3 years getting this together, and I'm pleased to say that it has been successful and gave me a great deal of pressure. So that was my creative outlet while Brad was declining.
We're speaking with Mary Daly of Atlanta, Georgia, and we're going to take a little break right here, and we'll be right back. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back. We're back talking with Mary Daly of Atlanta, Georgia, who has created an exercise video for caregivers and people with Alzheimer's to do together and to maintain their own health and positive attitude. Mary, I read one place where you said that in the beginning you felt resentful of having lost your own life, the quality of your own life, and that the thing that helped you most was that you finally gave up wanting your old life back and embraced your new life, and that when you did that, you found joy in the new, and one important piece of that new life was producing this video and interacting with people around the video project.
I had something that I could do that was right. helpful, and also it gave me strength. People told me that they thought sure. it was wonderful, and it made me feel good.
That's great, and that's a very important element. It's good that you get positive feedback. We all crave that, and this gave you an opportunity to get a little bit of that. Tell us how one can get the video if someone's interested.
Oh, well, if you go on the website, it's www.yourexercise, and I want to spell that for you because I didn't put an E before the X. It's YourExercise. .com. And the reason for that was that Scottish newspaper. You know, when you see a prescription sign, there's an R and the tail of the R comes uh-huh. down and the X goes over it. Well, if you look on the website, you will see your exercise with the R coming down and the X going across. And it says it's a prescription for Alzheimer's patients and their caregivers.
Oh, isn't that clever? Thank you. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, that sounds like a wonderful project. And I think that that's one of the elements that we don't often realize is part of the healthcare for all efforts of many countries is that they do prescribe things like exercise, like swimming. I have a cousin in Sweden who has a prescription to go to a water exercise class three times a week to help with her arthritis. So,
wonderful.
But there are a lot of these preventive things that keep you from needing some of the expensive medications, and that's good for your body, too.
That's right. Yeah. Well, what good news, then. Great Britain should go ahead and do what they're doing. You know, all of these exercises are done sitting down. They're done mm-hmm. in a chair. Mm-hmm. So, because he could no longer walk or anything. So, it's brought exercise to people who wouldn't normally think about exercising, and it is important for a lot of reasons. I will tell you one other thing of which I am really pleased. I took Brad to the aquarium here in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And while we were there, he had to go to the bathroom. Well, there aren't any. I asked the attendant where the family bathroom was. He said, we don't have one. Mm. So I had to take Brad into the ladies' room, into the handicap booth, which is, you know, not good for him. And the ladies sort of gave me looks. But I had to.
Sure.
So later, I called the Alzheimer's Association, and they, in turn, called a legislator who, in turn, introduced legislation which was passed, and they are going to put handicapped bathrooms in the airport, at the Hartsfield Airport.
There you go.
And also in the aquarium. So that's something that caregivers sometimes run into, no place to take them if you go out.
That's right. And as caregivers, we become sensitized to things that we probably never thought of before. I mean, you probably never missed the fact that there was no family bathroom at the aquarium. But now that you did notice it, it's good to take that a little farther and help to fix that for the next person.
Well, there were two reasons that I was glad to do that. First of all, so many, not just caregivers, but I thought about my son-in-law who had two little girls. If he takes them someplace, mm-hmm. he can't take them into the men's room.
Yeah.
And then I have a friend who's a husband of a wife who's disabled, and I said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, I look for the gas stations that have unisex bathrooms. He said, they're not clean or anything, but at least I can take her in there.
Yeah.
So that was one reason to be pleased, but the other was that I'm 82 now, but I was 81 when I was doing this business of trying to get the family bathrooms put in. And I think that no matter how old you are, if you see a need, you can try to do something about it. And if everybody would do that, especially the older people who do have some time that maybe the younger ones don't have, to write letters or to call, do it. You know, don't just sit there and do nothing.
That's wonderful. The other thing I wanted to follow up on is your use of the internet. I think most people think of the internet as this thing for young people, but there are lots of senior citizens out there who are using it to good advantage, and particularly when you're shut in for much of the time, it becomes your window on the world.
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you one thing that happened from the article you mentioned that was in the paper. I've been put in touch with friends I haven't seen since grammar school. And the emails that go back and forth are such a wonderful thing. When, as you say, I really don't travel a lot anymore, but this is my window to the world. And more older people are learning how wonderful it is. And it's really not all that difficult. And there are community classes to help you learn.
So there's support available through the Alzheimer's Association. There's support available through your church or synagogue and so forth. And the resources available in most communities now for caregivers.
Right.
Where in particular did you look besides the Alzheimer's Association? You said the hospital?
The Alzheimer's Association will give you a list. And on each list, if you talk to someone there, they in turn will say, oh, well, what you need is, in other words, you do a little networking until you find what you can afford and what's available. There are, for instance, there was one stage where Brad really needed to more people his own age to talk, and not someone just beside me. So I found a daycare at a local church, and they had a daycare just for Alzheimer's patients. It was wonderful. They gave him a hot meal and had activities, and it was not very expensive. So I couldn't afford for him to go all 5 days. Besides, I didn't want to take him 5 days. But for 3 days a week, for a while, he was there, and it was a wonderful resource. He enjoyed it, and so did I, because it gave me 4 or 5 hours for those days where I could pursue my own interests.
That's right. It served as a respite care for you also.
Yes, it certainly did. And there are, of course, a lot of people are caregiving for children or for returned veterans. But if you're older, then there are things available through Medicare that are of no cost. There's a local nursing association. They will send a visiting nurse to you. And, of course, later when he was bedridden, I leaned on hospice. They are marvelous people. They were so wonderful and allowed Brad to die at home as he had wanted. And we had discussed this. He didn't want any artificial, and he said, don't hook me up to any tubes.
Right.
So
the
hospice people understood this and were very supportive. It was, I would certainly recommend that to anyone in the final stages.
Now, we've been talking about Alzheimer's, but Alzheimer's is not the only source of dementia. And
no,
is it necessary to have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, or
No. Can
you look to these organizations, even if it's vascular dementia or just hardening of the arteries, as they used to say?
Absolutely. In fact, there is really no way to say definitely that it's Alzheimer's unless you have an autopsy, and that's a pretty extreme thing to go through.
Right.
No, you really, but there are tests that they run, and it gives you a very strong indication that it is Alzheimer's. But any kind of dementia, I don't care what you call it, the treatment is the same. For instance, Brad was also diagnosed as having Parkinson's disease. But it turned out later that he had something called Lewy body's disease. And I said, well, what's the difference? Well, the symptoms are a little different. What's the treatment? The treatment's the same. I said, well, what does it matter what you call it if you can treat it? He said, it's an academic thing for doctors.
Yeah.
So whether it's vascular or behavioral or whatever, if it's treated the same way, that's what you concentrate on.
Right. Now, you said that Brad was a very good patient, so he most of the time was very compliant with what you wanted to do?
Yes, most of the time. Sometimes, especially, I can remember one time he insisted he wanted to go outside, and it was cold and getting dark, and I wasn't about to let him go out. At that time, we were in an apartment where there was only one door in and out, so I stood with my back to the door, my arms folded, and I said, no, you can't go out. But why not? Well, I tried to tell him why not, but logic isn't something that works with somebody in that stage. And so physically, I just had to stand there. He got angry with me, but there was no way I was going to let him go out. So mm-hmm. if he'd been a larger man, I might have had a physical problem. But some men are, I have to say, sexually aggressive. Some are just plain aggressive by hitting and so forth. And in that case, you must put them someplace else. You cannot put up with that. But Brad was never that way. He would get angry and upset with me, or sometimes he would say, don't treat me like a baby. Well, at that point, we were able to talk with one another, and I said, well, Brad, I apologize. I don't mean to do that, but some days you don't respond to me, and other days, like today, you do. And I never know which day I'm going to find. And mm-hmm. he smiled and said, I know, I'm sorry. So we could discuss it, which was wonderful, but yeah. not everybody could.
Right, and as you say, if the caregiver is finding him or herself in a dangerous situation, that's when you really have to call for help.
Oh, yes, indeed. I have a friend, I had lunch with her yesterday, and she had to put her husband in a nursing home, and she did not want to do it. Oh, it made her feel just terrifically bad, and I understood so what she was going through, because our children wanted me to put Brad in a nursing home, and I said, as long as I'm physically able, I'm just not going to do it. They were afraid that I would fold, you know.
And right.
But I knew that as long as I could do it, I wanted to do it. But my friend had to put her husband in a home, and she's still mourning that. It's very hard on her.
Mm-hmm.
But she had to do it. Her husband was just, he's a large man, and she simply couldn't handle it.
Right. Right. So there's a tremendous amount of guilt that can go with this scenario as well.
Absolutely. And I'm healthy in that I don't have any major problems, but I do have some. And I realized that I was slipping into a mild depression because I was crying a lot and so forth. So I went to the doctor right away because I had read to be careful of this. And he said, let me give you something. So he put me on a medication, which has helped tremendously. And on the advice of my doctor, I have stayed on it for a while. After Brad died, I thought I was prepared for it, and I thought that I, you know, was all right. About 2 months after, I fell into a depression that was a surprise to me. And yet, he said, stay on this medication. So accept mm-hmm. the help and realize the symptoms. Educate yourself.
Yeah, I mean, as much as we know that it's time and we think we're prepared for it, somehow the finality of it hits you in a way that you don't anticipate.
Absolutely, and it will sort of sneak up on you. You think you're just fine.
Yeah.
As I said, for 2 months, people would say, how are you doing? And I would say, I'm doing well, thank you. But I really wasn't.
Yeah, right. So you've learned some important lessons, Mary, about taking care of yourself, and we appreciate your sharing them with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and I hope that if anyone listening is a caregiver, I want you to know my hat is off to you. I've been there, done that, and I don't think anybody who's done this will say that it's an easy job, and yet it's a job I wouldn't have given up. I love my husband. He was a wonderful man, and I'm grateful that I could be there for him. I really love my experience, even though at times I would go into the other room and sit on the bed and cry and say aloud, I can't do this, I can't do this.
Right.
But, you know, it's really hard to see someone you love fade that way.
Well, thank you very much, Mary. It sounds like you did a wonderful job. And thank you very much for the wonderful exercise video that you created and the words of wisdom for all caregivers, no matter what the condition. Stay with us now. We're going to reach into our mailbag and read our letter from Nicola. This program is brought to you as a public service by the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance. Read about us on the website at powerfulpatient.org. We will be glad to answer as many of your questions as possible. If we use your question on the air, we will send you a copy of our theme CD, Wayfaring Stranger by Clinton Winford. Again, the website is powerfulpatient.org. We've gotten lots of wonderful questions, most of them pretty specific to people's situations. But we got a wonderful question here from Nicola that I thought everyone would enjoy listening to. She says, I was toying with the idea of getting a medical bracelet, but I wasn't sure if it was worth doing. What kind of details would be best to put on it? I assume just putting down that I have von Hippel-Lindau disease would mean nothing to emergency people. Well, Nicola, you're quite right. And so we went looking on the internet for some good guidance. I found a really good article about medic alert bracelets and other devices to convey information to emergency medical people. But it didn't get at the question that is really here at the core. If you have a complex medical condition and a very thick medical record, how do you boil that down and put it in a prominent place so that emergency people will have the information that they need? The author of that article is Rod Brohard, who has agreed to speak with us today. Rod serves as the guide to first aid at about.com, an information website that's owned by the New York Times. He is a paramedic. He works full-time as a paramedic on an ambulance, and so he has that emergency perspective that we were looking for. Let's talk with Rod Brohard.
So as a paramedic, you're going out with the fire department or in an ambulance or...
I'm in an ambulance, and we do respond with the fire department on a lot of our 911 emergency calls. I work with an emergency medical technician partner who, for the foreseeable future, happens to be my wife, as a matter of fact. It's just the two of us. Occasionally, we get a fire crew with us, probably more like 60% of the time we have a fire crew that responds along with us as well.
So when you're responding to a call with someone who has an underlying rare disease medical condition, could be any rare disease really, what kinds of things do you wish you knew about that person? Let's say that they've been in an automobile accident, they're unconscious. What kinds of things do you wish you knew?
We need to know for everyone, actually. We'll start off kind of on an overall view. We need to know things like medical allergies or medications that they take. If there is an underlying condition, then it's great to know the name of that underlying condition. I'm not sure that you'd fit von Hippel-Lindau on a medic alert bracelet with anything left over for any other information.
Right.
But if it's something that is recognizable, it's great to have an abbreviation or something. Let's pick some of the more common underlying conditions that affect folks. Diabetes is probably the most common example, and in fact, I would say most of our folks wearing medical ID bracelets are wearing them because they're diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why that's important is because diabetics can find themselves unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
With very little warning, and when we arrive on scene, if we know they're a diabetic, that is something we can absolutely do something about immediately. And that's why it's good to have that identification on the outside, where it's easy to find, universally recognizable, something we expect to find. We'll look at that information and fix it right then and there.
So in the case of diabetes, you would measure their sugar and immediately determine whether that's the issue.
Absolutely.
Or a contributing issue, anyway.
Absolutely, and if it's low, we're going to fix it right away. If it's high, there's not much we're going to do about that right here, but we are going to fix that by transporting them to the hospital, and you know, we'll start by giving them some fluid. The hospital will start to address their sugar with some insulin and that sort of thing. But if it's low, we can absolutely fix that immediately. We can give them a sugar directly into the vein, and they'll wake up in, you know, minutes.
Right.
Most of the time.
Right. So any medications that people are taking?
Medications aren't as important unless there are some specifics, and it's a good idea to talk to your doctor about these. things that affect blood clotting ability are huge. So if you're taking medications that actually thin your blood, heparin, Coumadin, Coumadin is probably the most common. If you're taking an unusually high dose of aspirin on a daily basis, anything that's going to affect your ability to clot is important for us because it changes how we treat, say, you mentioned the vehicle accident patient. It's going to change how we treat that vehicle accident patient if we think that there's a higher chance that they have some internal bleeding.
Hmm.
Externally, we're going to see if there's bleeding, but internally, there's no way to know, sometimes until it's too late, because the only way that we can see bleeding internally is by watching their vital signs change, and by the time your vital signs begin to change, that only happens in the body's response to a lot of blood loss, and that is kind of, we're chasing the eight ball then. We're already behind.
So if I heard you correctly, one should have a conversation with their doctor about anything that might cause them to be unconscious, anything that a first responder definitely needs to know before they can treat you.
Absolutely.
And here's a scenario. This may be a reach, but let's try it on for size. In von Hippel-Lindau, there is a tumor of the adrenal gland called a pheochromocytoma, and these are difficult to diagnose, so they're often not diagnosed, maybe even for years. But if someone's in an automobile accident, for example, it can cause a pheochrisis, and the patient may not even know they have a pheo, but if the emergency room personnel knew, for example, that this person has VHL, they might, if they were truly on their toes, conjecture that a pheo is a possibility. Now, is that something that, obviously, it's not all going to fit on a bracelet, but you mentioned in your article something about medical information I could put on a USB or put on the internet or in a wallet card that maybe would get to the emergency room people, if not the ambulance people.
There are several different ways to keep medical information in an organized way that's going to help us out. One option is to wear the medical alert or whatever medical ID bracelets. Medical ID bracelets are good. Services like medical alert, and I'll pick on medical alert just because they're a nonprofit organization, but there are some for-profit services out there as well. Services like that have a way to maintain medical information in a database in a clearinghouse, that there is information on the medical ID bracelet that allows the hospital crew to access it. Not going to see an ambulance crew doing the accessing very often, so we pretty much go by whatever you can fit on the bracelet.
Right.
But on every single medical alert bracelet, specifically, is a patient identification number and a phone number to call. So once we get them to the emergency room, it's quite common for the emergency room staff, plenty more of them, they have telephones there,
right,
they have fax machines, which is probably the most important part of this equation, because what they'll do is they'll call the telephone number, give the patient identification number, and they get faxed to them patient information, medical condition information. If they've been diagnosed with an adrenal tumor, that information could be passed along as well, much more specific than anything that you'd be able to fit in the two or three lines you get engraved on the ID bracelet.
Right.
You can do the same thing on your own. You can do a medical ID bracelet that says, see wallet card, or, medical information in purse, or, however you want to put it on there, and carry medical information in a much more comprehensive way in your wallet or in your purse, so that the folks on the scene, and if it's that close and that easily accessible, even the ambulance crew is likely to check it.
Mm-hmm.
As a rule, dig through wallets. Just because of all of the you know, issues that go along with that. But the wallets and the purses certainly go with us to the hospital and get turned over to the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, they will definitely crack that thing open, take a look through there, take out any medical information they can find, and dig through it. And if that medical information is then organized in a really good way, they've quickly gotten all the information that they need to apply that however it fits, if it fits, into mm-hmm. whatever the condition is that's going on right then,
right.
Car accident or whatever.
Right. So even if you have like a compound fracture, your clotting ability is certainly relevant. Any kind of medication things would be relevant, but any of these more subtle things, we might want to include them, but including them all on a bracelet is going to be hard. So we have to kind of compress the information and make it accessible in the most judicious way.
You happen to have tumors that are affecting your bone density, for example, and you have fractures.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who has brittle bones from whatever condition they might happen to have, they can get fractures much easier than someone who does not.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at someone with multiple fractures as having been in a pretty serious car accident. But if you can get multiple fractures by falling on the sidewalk, then the chance of bleeding internally is a lot less. You see what I mean? So
mm-hmm.
it changes how much weight we give each condition.
Right, you may not have had as much trauma as the ambulance people are assuming,
right.
Because it didn't take that much trauma to do this job.
It helps us paint the picture in every direction. It helps us understand how the forces that we're witnessing, if we're looking at a vehicle accident, and you see, sometimes you'll see a car accident, and you just kind of look at it and go, you know, it just doesn't fit. The level of injury that we see on the patient doesn't really fit
mm-hmm.
with the car accident that we're looking at.
We're speaking with Rod Brohard, a paramedic from Northern California. In just a moment, he's going to help us compress our bulky medical information into the essence that is needed by emergency personnel. Stay with us now. We'll be right back. Please go to powerfulpatient.org on the internet. You will find the program guides for this show with information about the people that we've spoken with, the websites that we've referenced, and some other background on the information that we've discussed. And as always, we would appreciate your support in making this show happen. Please donate to the Cancer Research Fund and bring us back another day. Thank you. Stay with us now, and we'll be right back.
You know, even if you're in the hospital where you normally go, I know sometimes I've heard the doctor say, oh, well, I'll just look through his medical record. Well, my son's medical record is about 6 inches thick. And how do you help people get to the salient details in short order? Because they're not going to go through a 6-inch medical record in the emergency room, right?
And they don't go through a 6-inch medical record. I mean, they will, and in most cases, it depends on what kind, the way that the medical records are organized. And that's kind of important, too, and that's what I was saying earlier. It kind of depends on how you organize the information that you put. Stuffing things in your wallet or your purse that basically are, you know, pamphlets on, you know, von Hippel-Lindau may or may not actually help out.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, much better to give me the bullet points of what's important. You know, are your tumors putting pressure in on your spine? Do you have issues with clotting? Do you have a tumor on your adrenal gland that you're aware of? If that's the case, then know any particular specifics about your case are important, as well as the diagnosis itself.
So you're basically looking for the one-page summary.
Absolutely, absolutely. And most, you know, most medical records that are presented, you know, with the intent of kind of bringing somebody up to speed on what's going on. If you look, sometimes medical records are presented in lots of different ways, but most of the time when a physician does, say, for example, a history and physical assessment on a on a patient, they are presenting that history and physical assessment with the hopes that another physician at some other point, especially when ER docs do this, they're presenting it with the idea that some other doc's going to read this.
Right.
So they'll list often the pertinent and most important diagnoses on the history and physical. When you look at the history and physical assessments that physicians have dictated, some of them will have, in bullet point form, these are his major diagnoses. They mm-hmm. may or may not have caught them all. There are times when they
yes.
miss important stuff, but it shows you just kind of how they think. They want it quick and easy.
Right, and if you're handing off to another medical professional, you need in 1 to 2 minutes to be able to get that person up to speed on what you need them to do.
Absolutely, and they only tune into what they consider important too. We do verbal reports when we pass patients off in the emergency room. Probably, you know, I mean, folks have seen this on
television.
ER.
Yeah,
ER is a good example. ER does a relatively good, albeit very dramatic, portrayal of what happens in a real emergency room. And when the ambulance crew rolls in with a patient on their gurney and starts rattling off that information,
mm-hmm.
a lot of that information is very pertinent to what's going on with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
The physician has already looked at the patient and visually made a determination of what he or she thinks is really important. And those are the cues they're listening for in that verbal report. They don't hear it all. They just hear the things they care about. And even listening for those, if they're listening to hear what the blood pressure is, because the patient looks like they might be in shock, and so I want to know what the blood pressure is, so I'm listening to your report, sort of. I'm mm-hmm. looking really at the patient, and I'm feeling around, and I'm kind of tuned into the report and kind of not. And you get to the part where you rattle off the blood pressure. I pause for a moment, listen, and what do I hear? It's a relatively normal blood pressure. I then ignore it. It didn't matter. And all I log in my brain is, it was normal.
Okay.
That's all I remember. I don't remember what it was. Doesn't matter. It's normal.
And to a certain extent, what's going on is what they call triage.
Absolutely.
Right. So the doctor's trying to determine, is this someone that I should be taking care of immediately? Or if he waits while I set somebody's leg, is that going to be all right? Or if this person sits in the waiting room for the next 6 hours, it's going to be okay.
Absolutely. As well as, you know, even if this patient is significant, is there right now something that I as a physician need to do, or can I go ahead and step out of the room, let the nurses do, you know, X, X, and X, the things that I'm going to ask them to do, I'm going to walk away, they're going to get those things done, and I'll come back and check on them later. And those are all decision points that the physicians are making in the first 10 seconds. That first 10 seconds is usually when the ambulance crew, the ambulance paramedic is giving a report to the physician, and or the nurse, and the information that report's lost. So if there's something chronic like von Hippel-Lindau, and I guarantee you there are physicians that don't recognize that name.
Right. We're very aware of that.
I'm sure you are.
All too aware. They may or may not remember one paragraph from medical school.
Absolutely. And that's the problem with all rare diseases.
Right.
Everything gets, you know, there's a lot out there to know about.
Sure.
And there are, I'll run into patients who have something that's quite rare, and they know it quite well.
Sure.
And are,
because they live it.
Exactly. And seem to feel as if we should know as much as they do about it, when it's much more likely that in the next 6 months, I'm not going to see that particular condition again, but I'll see diabetes 4 times a day for the next 6 months.
Right. But there are thousands of rare diseases, and so what we tell people is they can't expect everybody in the medical world to know all the details about their disease, that we as the families need to take some responsibility for helping that doctor get hooked into the system and up to speed as quickly as possible. Do that same kind of handoff that you're doing when you come in with your patient on the gurney. We have to similarly hand off our medical records in a way that this doctor is going to be able to do his best job for us.
Absolutely, and that's extremely important, and that's a great message to get to patients. We also get this, we also try to put the message, or I try to put the message out there to caregivers,
right,
who listen to family and patients when it's a disease you don't know about, you should go to the experts. The people who've done all the research are the experts. I don't care whether you went to medical school or not, it doesn't really matter. You understand your condition.
Right.
So tell me about it.
Yes, and the biggest problem we have is when a doctor says, wait a minute, you don't tell me what you have. I'll tell you what you have.
Yeah.
It's like, get off it, Buster.
Absolutely. And it happens. A good paramedic has kind of an A, type A personality anyway.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Otherwise, he wouldn't work fast enough to do the job right.
Exactly. So you tend to kind of want to take over, and I understand. But you know, there are those of us out there, and I think the trend is growing that are willing to listen. If it's something that we're not aware of, we're willing to listen.
Right.
But for sure, I won't have time on the scene to get up to speed on the condition entirely.
Right.
What I'll need to know is, what do you have? What is the condition? Explain the condition to me in, you know, 15 words or less. And then, what about that condition affects what's going on with you right now?
So it's not so important that he know that it's a VHL. It is important that he know that you have a vascular tumor of the brainstem, or, you know, something in the lumbar spine. And so don't give me a lumbar puncture, please, until you check my record.
Absolutely. And those are the things, you know, or don't do my lumbar puncture without an x-ray. Those are the kinds of things that we need to know.
But as you say, it's not so important that they know the name of this condition or even the full implications of the condition. It's just, what are the salient things that I need to know right now in order to treat this person in this emergency?
Absolutely.
Now, when you work with one of these online records places, is there someone helping you filter through this mountain of information and come up with the bits and pieces that you need to put on, or do you need to do this with your own doctor?
You know, it's something you'll probably have to do with your own physician for most of these types of things. You know, the USB drive idea, there are a couple of different services out there. One is basically you buy the drive and the software, you plug it into your computer, you put whatever you want on it, and then that's what you carry around with you in the hopes that when you actually need to use this thing, you can plug it into a computer someplace else and use it. In my article on it talks about how the problem that we have with those types of USB drives and so on is, first of all, most ambulances don't have computers on them yet. I would say probably the vast majority of ambulances don't have a computer available to plug it in, so it's not going to be used in the field. As far as in the emergency room, they certainly don't have any shortage of computers in most emergency rooms, but they're all on a network. I'm not entirely sure that if I was a network administrator for that hospital, that I would be willing to let the nurses and the ER crews plug a USB drive that I'm not entirely sure where that came from.
That's a very good point, because of the fear of some sort of virus.
For them, it's much easier just to call a service and have them fax over the info.
Sounds like staying low-tech is the better way to do it, because it's more easily accessed.
There are a lot of times when folks are going to look at the thing and not even understand what it is, but the understanding that then carries medical information needs to be on it somewhere and
right,
clearly identified, and I'm not sure that they're universal enough yet that folks are putting two and two together.
So I'm hearing that first of all, the medical alert bracelet is the most broadly recognized.
Absolutely.
And then from that bracelet, you could direct people to a wallet card or something in your purse. You mentioned also there's one that goes on your refrigerator, but then, of course, that only works at home.
That only works at home.
But if people are shut in, there might be a usefulness to that.
If you do spend most of your time at home, it's not a bad idea to just have a spot where you put everything.
Right.
I can tell you that most ambulance crews and fire crews, most first responders in general, are going to look. We'll look in the refrigerator. You're not necessarily looking for those kinds of medical information. I'll look in the refrigerator to see if there's insulin.
Right.
I'll look in the refrigerator to see if there is food. You know, if I find a patient that's unconscious, and I look in the fridge, and all they have is, you know, a six-pack of beer and pizza that's growing something.
Right.
And I know that they haven't been eating.
Yeah.
And that might actually be their problem. We will look in some kind of standard places looking for medications. We'll look in the mm-hmm. bathroom. We'll look in the cabinets in the kitchen to see if we find medications stored there. If you organize all your medications into one spot, mm-hmm. then it's a good bet, if, especially if that one spot's in the kitchen or in the bathroom, we're going to find it.
Yeah.
And then we're good to go. Put a piece of paper with medical information right there next to your medications, and you're good to go.
So okay.
Those are things that we typically do, I think, nationwide as a group.
And then from your bracelet, you could direct people to a service that could be phoned, or
Absolutely.
Or perhaps something that you could log into on the internet?
Absolutely.
Okay. But these USB drives are probably not optimal.
USB drives are probably not there yet. I have a feeling that there are some other things on the horizon, radio frequency ID cards, which allow a reader to read them from a distance. So you could actually, you could wave somebody's wallet under a reader and it would read the information on the card, and that's even better than the USB drive. Those types of things, you can't put any information on, you can't put a live file on there that's going to explode into a virus, so that doesn't, mm-hmm. that can't happen. So those types of medical information media are
right.
probably going to leapfrog the pen drive concept. I think the pen drive concept its time will have come by the time it even gets there.
So we could have something the size of a credit card that would either have a magnetic strip on it, like we're used to, or could have this RF reader, which works sort of like the FastPass in the superhighways, right?
Absolutely. It works exactly like the FastPass.
These new readers, though, can carry more information than can be stored on one of those magnetic strips on your credit card in something that's pretty much the same dimension.
They can, or the reader just gives you a 25-digit number.
Mm-hmm.
That 25-digit number is your number. So all the reader does is reads that number and then goes through the internet to a database and says, what do you got on patient number 1234567891010?
Right.
And it goes to that database. The database pops up with, oh, that happens to be so-and-so. Here's a picture to make sure that really is so-and-so. And, you know, here is the information that you're going to need to treat that person, oh, by the way, maybe even a little area for cautions. They're allergic to iodine. They happen to be, they happen to have a tumor on, pressing on their carotid artery. They have, so on and so forth. I mean, all of these, mm-hmm. this information could then be accessed.
I think the other message that I'm hearing out of this is that there's nothing magic that's going to compile this one-page summary, that the patient and their physician need to work together to design that and make sure that information is in this one of these prominent spots that we've been discussing.
Absolutely.
So there are two scenarios that we need to prepare for. One is, as you say, the sort of predictable medical crises that may go along with the condition that you're living with. And the second one is, let's say, God forbid, I'm in an automobile accident. What is it that I want those first responders to know immediately?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What are the things about my condition that can affect being injured and make it worse for me?
Well, Rod, thank you very much for speaking with us on this topic, and thank you for all the good information that you have at firstaid.about.com. Please see the program guide at powerfulpatient.org, and we will have the pointers there for Rod's specific articles about medic alert devices and about chronic illness. I'm from the school of, if you carry an umbrella, it won't rain. So this is your umbrella, and please prepare it. so that it won't rain and you won't need emergency services. But just in case, it's good to have that one-page summary. If you sit down with your physician and ask that person to help you prepare that handoff document for emergency care workers, what is it that they would need to know about your condition if they were to find you unconscious, either as a result of an accident or as a result of some predictable issue that has to do with your condition? So be prepared, and hopefully you're not going to ever need it. And very many thanks to Nicola for her wonderful question. We have our CD on the way to her to thank her for that. And we hope to use your questions soon on the air. So send us your questions and be with us next week. Next week, we're going to talk with Deb Hogan, who has a wonderful CD out called Forever in His Care. And she'll talk with you about her medical history, her family medical history, and how she manages stress through prayer. Be well and be a powerful patient.